All the summer, we're in conversation with Wisconsin executives and their companies that have taken root here. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Founded over a century ago as Snap-on Wrench Company in Milwaukee, Kenosha headquartered Snap-on is our next stop. It's bread and butter tools group catering to vehicle repair technicians. But there's a lot more to this company that specializes in manufacturing and marketing of tools and diagnostic equipment for sectors like transportation and ag, aviation, medical. Join in on all things Snap-on, manufacturing, corporate culture, and more. 800-642-1234. Nick Pinchuk has been chairman and CEO of Snap-on since 2007 and chairman of the board since 2009. Nick, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks. How's it going, Kate?
Going well. But when I think of Snap-on, I immediately think of tools. And you've really diversified your company a lot over the decades. You're in a lot of different sectors. I just ticked off some. But can you give us some examples of things we might not know you make?
Well, look, I think I can. I mean, fundamentally, it's not that we've transformed our company. We have followed the changes in the we're rooted in repair in all kinds of repair, and we follow the changes in those industries. You know, one of the things that if you just look at cars, you know, vehicles, for example, we're much more fly-by-wire today than we were 5 years ago, and or even 20 years ago. So the change has been tremendous, and some of our tools are still very important. You know, we sell more hand tools today than we ever did before, even though the cars are more fly-by-wire. But we also have laptops for cars, some of which that wield databases that are 270 billion records associated with car repair. And so it puts that data in the hands of the technician to engage the changes in the vehicles. Because you know, a technician today isn't dark, dumb, and dirty. They're acting like electrical engineers practically. That's an example. And then the other thing is, one other thing I'd add is, we started in auto repair, but what we learned was, we weren't just a company that did auto repair. We thought we made wrenches for vehicles, but actually, we're a company that enables critical tasks. So if professionals are working in any critical tasks, that's where the penalty for failure is high and the need for repeatability and reliability is paramount. A Snap-on tool is good for it. And that's our natural place. So it rolls us out of the garage into places like aerospace and aviation and ag and a whole bunch of other things.
And we're going to talk about data and technology in a moment, but who are Snap-on's biggest customers?
We have millions. You see, one of the things about Snap-on, one of the things you got to know about Snap-on is we have a vivid brand. It's the outward sign of the pride and dignity that working men and women take in their profession. People wear our jackets at county fairs, our hats. They shape their wedding cakes in the shape of a Snap-on. I ain't kidding either. You know, and they put Snap-on wrenches in the hands of their newborns because they believe whatever touches the newborns hands first will influence their life forever, for better or worse. So it's a tremendous brand. You know, that's one of the things. The other thing we do is, starting way back in the beginning when our founder said, go into the garages and sell directly to the mechanics. Mm-hmm. We sell directly to the mechanics. So we have millions of customers. So unlike most manufacturing companies, if you think of it, we are heavily vertically integrated, and we have millions of customers, hundreds of thousands of millions of customers in technicians across the country, where we put a tool into the actual hand of the user, unlike most manufacturers. And we sell to 200,000 to 300,000 shops just in the United States, just in that one sector alone.
And let me ask you this, because you don't really rely then on the brick and mortar store model at all, in that, you know, you have these franchise dealers and you use these mobile vans. Why have you gone that route?
Because the whole thing about our business, our principal value creating mechanism, is we're in repair, and cars and planes and everything keeps changing. So what we do is, we are in workplaces for more hours, for more weeks, for more days than any other manufacturer. So we observe the work and we realize what tools might make it easier. This is what drives our business. We are a company that, if you think about it, cars, once we sell wrenches to mechanics, don't they have the wrenches and they can use them forever? That's wrong, because the cars keep changing physically. geometrically, and they need different wrenches, just in wrenches, but it's also around things that would require a technician to deal with the electronics. So we see the difficulties they have, and then we come out with tools that will enable them. This is true across the number of different sectors. So our principal value creating mechanism is enabled by the physical contact and the physical observation in the work. Hmm. We say Snap-on people are the people of work, and so we are.
Well, Nick, I'm going to reintroduce you here for a moment as we talk with Nick Pinchuk, who is the chairman and CEO of Snap-on, Kenosha-based company, as part of our conversations with CEOs and C-suite executives in Wisconsin, companies rooted here. You can join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. Your latest annual report says Snap-on has 9 manufacturing facilities here in the U.S., 1 facility in Milwaukee, 19 locations outside our country. Is manufacturing in the U.S. becoming more difficult?
No, I don't think so. I think manufacturing in the U.S. could become easier. And there's a couple of reasons for this. One of the things is we love manufacturing in the U.S. Our vans, 80% of what we sell off the van is made here in America. And a hand tool is 50% labor. Check the labor on a TV sometime. Okay, it's much lower. So the thing is, we're able to do that. So we thrive on United States manufacturing. One of the things we love about Wisconsin is, you know, one of the underrated things about manufacturer, any business, is the power of place. Mm-hmm. These people, when they move to China and they don't have a good experience, it's mostly because they put the factory in the wrong place. Well, we've put our factories in the best places. We're here in Kenosha, and the people in Kenosha have been the wellspring of our energy and capability for more than 90 years, because we moved here 10 years after we got founded. So that's an important thing. I think American manufacturing is great. The difficulty is this. Sometimes, as you had in my tape, sometimes you believe, or you believe that Americans no longer believe in manufacturing. You know, I said 90% of the people think that manufacturing is important, but only 30% say they'd like to have their children become manufacturers. They believe if you go into manufacturing, you settle for the consolation prize of our society. But in reality, think about how important it is. Historians have said that America is ascendant because of the fact that we've had makers and fixers stretched from sea to shining sea across this country. And we have had proximate proof of that, because when the COVID hit and fear was in the streets and people were in their houses, we had people who met that fear with vigilance and stayed at their post to make sure that our society didn't disintegrate while we engaged and defeated the COVID. And among the first line of those were manufacturers.
Let me jump here and look a little more closely at the economics. You know, transportation costs for offshore manufacturing are going up. Your labor costs, where companies used to save, you know, by orders of magnitude on labor, that too is rising. What pressures or challenges do you feel with your plants operating in other countries?
You know, to tell you the truth, you know, our view of this is sort of like, go back to the inimitable Roseanne Dana from Saturday Night Live. It's always something. So managing over those kinds of supply chain problems and inflation is the task of management. So yes, we see those changes, but we're not disrupted by it. I do think, though, coming out of the COVID, I would be disappointed if Americans and the American government didn't see that shortening the supply chains wasn't a great problem. It's not so much the cost or the variation of the cost. It's the fact that cars can't be made because there aren't chips. So it's those who have shorter supply chains. Snap-on does, by the way, have shorter supply chains because we make in the countries where we manufacture. So that would be, I think, of rising importance. And I think that's what's going to follow out of that. This, people are going to move toward America in this kind of thing. Because supply chains, you know, coming out of the last great inflation, they moved overseas, made the supply chains efficient and said, oh, that's great, isn't it? Well, now you can see that things like the COVID can create microviscosities from place to place, and it disrupts industry. So people, are going to move to try to insulate against that. And that means coming to America. I think America has a lot of opportunity for that. One of the things we do need, though, is to upskill the American workforce. Because right now there are 900,000 manufacturing jobs open. And there are two reasons for that. We don't have the skills, and two, manufacturing and other technical careers have a PR problem. People view them as what other people's kids do.
So if you had a larger labor pool, is what you're saying, is that that would help you to think more favorably for you to perhaps reshore or bring that manufacturing back more to the U.S.?
Actually, I'm not talking about Snap-on because we never left. You see, the whole thing is we to the extent we have factories outside the United States, they are aimed at those markets, therefore short supply chains. So we never moved anything overseas because we had this view from the beginning. We wanted to make in the markets where we sold. But there's a whole industry associated with manufacturing that I think would look at it differently.
Hmm.
This is the kind of thing.
Snap-on CEO Nick Pinchuk with us leads the Kenosha-based global manufacturer of tools, of equipment, diagnostic tools. Join in on the industry of tools, corporate citizenship, manufacturing, as we've been talking about, 800-642-1234. You're listening to The Morning Show, back in a minute with Nick Pinchuk here in the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our Wisconsin C-suite conversations today with Kenosha-headquartered Snap-on. In 2021, bringing in $4.25 billion in sales revenue, highest amount in company history. That's highlighted in their annual report. Join in 800-642-1234. CEO Nick Pinchuk with us for about nine more minutes. Nick, you mentioned earlier about the software division that creates the diagnostic programs for vehicles and databases with 220 billion records. How much of a challenge is it for your company to keep these records secure?
Well, of course, these days it's getting a greater challenge, but it's part of our task. I mean, I think it's one of the great focuses because the database is, those 270 billion data points are actually proprietary to us and no one else has them. So when you realize that, and no one else has the possibility to create them. And so when you realize that's such an advantage, you have to spend a lot of time doing that. And we spend a considerable time trying to protect ourselves in that situation. You know, of course, this is a difficult time for this because the Russians and everybody are trying to penetrate. But so far we've been okay.
Along those lines, you had announced your company had a ransomware data breach earlier this year, exposing associate data, franchise data, personal, employee data like social security numbers. And the news report said the Russian hacking group Conti took responsibility. How did you respond to this attack?
Someone called me 8:00 at night. I was up all night. You know, we basically rode to the sound of guns. We saw that they were there. And so we started to configure a solution to make sure operations went forward. So we were talking to our Australian business in the middle of the night, seeing how that solution would work. And then it went to the UK business and we saw how that worked. And by the time it got to the United States, we were up and going. Now, there were some things that weren't going, of course, but generally we didn't miss too much of a beat in terms of operations. We did lose some data, unfortunately. But in terms of personal data, but in fact, the operations moved reasonably well. So the quarter kind of shook it off. If you looked at last quarter, it was a record quarter in sales and profits for us, even though we had this breach.
With that breach, though, what did you do for the people or the employees whose data was exposed?
Well, how this happens is you got to figure out what you lose. And when we found that out, we notified them and then we provided them, data monitoring services at the company's cost for a relatively long period of time and talk them through how they could protect themselves against any problem. And so far, it seems to be going okay.
Talking with Nick Pinchuk, Chairman and CEO of Snap-on, headquartered in Kenosha. You can join the conversation, 800-642-1234. Nick, let's talk workforce. You have about 12,800 employees. The pandemic, as you've seen, has been called the Great Resignation, the Great Reshuffle. How is it impacting Snap-on and your labor force?
No impact.
Why is that?
because we kept working. You see, the thing is, when your factories are working, if you think about it, during the pandemic, how many people ate? How many people ordered from Amazon? Well, how many people used ambulances or fire trucks? Well, all that occurred because of, you received deliveries because of truck drivers who couldn't work from home, and factory work, warehouse workers who couldn't work from home, and mechanics who couldn't work from home, and factory workers who couldn't work from home. So 2/3 of the population was working. Here, we sent some of the people home, but most of them, including myself, stayed here every day because we were part of the people of work who actually were at work. And so one of the good things about that is we didn't lay anybody off. When we went into the pandemic, we said to ourselves, look, our most important factor is our people. One of our most important. And one of the disadvantages, so we didn't lay anybody off, because one of the disadvantages of saying your people are important is on occasion, in difficult times, you have to act like it.
So are you saying, sounds like you really believe in having your employees at the office or at their location.
They are at the office.
At the office, yes. So what impact do you think work from home has had on retention and recruitment and retention of employees?
It hasn't been a problem for us. You know, there are small pockets of this from time to time. You see, the whole thing about it is that I think, wouldn't you want to work for Snap-on? You see, it's a company that people make wedding cakes in the shape of your trucks. It's a company that clearly makes a difference. You know, Emerson said, you know, when a successful life is to be confident that even one person lived better because of what you did. And our people believe that. Well, and so working for Snap-on, the people here have been here for middle decades, you know, 15 years. So when you walk in the door, chances are you're gonna be here 30 years. So I think one of the things is that the people all came back, and generally it's been working okay for us. And I think part of it is we just didn't stop.
What is Snap-on doing to encourage diversity and inclusion at the company?
Well, look, I think the thing is this is a kind of thing that we're doing just about, you know, many of the things that you've probably heard before from other CEOs. Our particular challenge is our customer base is not particularly diverse. So some of the diverse population in the United States are underrepresented in that customer base. So I think one of the most important things we are doing is trying to focus the upskilling, the technical education on some of these populations. Certainly here in Wisconsin, we're doing that with a number of different schools like Gateway and others. And then around the country, working with historically Black universities and colleges, and also partnering with a bunch of different community colleges who are focusing those particular populations. You know, Snap-on has I talked about guiding curriculum. Snap-on has a founding member of National Coalition of Certification Centers. So we have, this is a program by which we guide students in technical careers to learn the right things that they can use in the workplace. So their skills are right up to snuff in terms, right up to date in terms of the common challenges. And so we have certified, 240,000 students to date, 33,000 already this year, and 65,000 last year. So that's a program that is embracing the diverse populations and moving them more into our customer base, and therefore giving us an opportunity to bring them into Snap-on.
We only have about a minute left here. William from Frederick sent us an email and said that they were a service tech for 9 years, always relied on Snap-on tools, and they say Snap-on's business sales model works really well. In that framework, I'm wondering, Snap-on has kept its headquarters in Wisconsin, you know, for more than a century. What could our state do to nurture businesses here? What could help the business culture?
I've lived all over the world. I lived in Asia for 11 years myself. And, you know, I've gone from country to country to country and jurisdiction to jurisdiction. And the simple point is the government has to act like they believe business is good for the population, for the people. And they have to be receptive and work with business to try to help them go forward and to nurture them. It's simple as that, I think. It's attitudinal more than any particular item. And so the more business seems, the more the government seems receptive, the better business likes it in that area. And then secondly, we already have it here in Wisconsin, is we have a huge number of schools who turn out great people. And then Wisconsin, I'll tell you, power of place, great culture, working men and women who focus on a job and really revel in making a difference in their lives. This is why we stayed here. And we built a new building. We just built a new building in our parking lot, 100,000 square foot building, probably maybe one of the only ones built in Kenosha in a long time. So we're about to expand right here on the Kenosha campus.
Nick, good to talk with you. Thank you for joining us.
Sure. My pleasure.
Nick Pinchuk, CEO of Snap-on since 2007, chairman of the board since 2009. All the summer, we're rolling out this series of conversations with leaders from Wisconsin's largest employers. You can find these conversations at WPR.org/mornings. Connect with me on LinkedIn. Find me under my name, Kate Archer Kent. News is next here on the Ideas Network. U.S. Air Force Band performing Your Grand Old Flag. Ahead of Independence Day, we talk about the American flag on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. The White House issued a proclamation earlier this month ahead of Flag Day that said our flag belongs to all Americans, and its red, white, and blue colors are woven into a rich tapestry of different cultures, backgrounds, and beliefs which connect us and honor our shared history. Join in with your questions about flag etiquette and history, 800-642-1234. David Janik is president of the National Flag Day Foundation, focused on patriotism and the lessons of the American flag. It is based in Wapaka in Ozaukee County, recognized by Congress, official birthplace of Flag Day. David, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, Woodrow Wilson established June 14th as Flag Day in 1916. How did you celebrate Flag Day 2 weeks ago?
We had our annual Flag Day celebration in Wapaka. It's always the second Sunday in June, typically before Flag Day. And we had a fantastic patriotic program in the morning, and we honored the volunteers of the honor flight groups from around the state and Illinois with a fantastic turnout. We had many speakers, including the vice chair national of the VFW. And then we had our patriotic parade and our family day, ending with fireworks at night.
I would imagine there were many flags on display.
Oh, of course.
Well, everyone has a different story of the American flag, and I'm wondering, what is your story? What is significant to you about the American flag?
Well, the flag to me represents the freedom and the ability to do things that other people in other countries can't do, to speak our mind, to speak our hearts, and to honor the flag and to honor those who have created the environment in our country that give us this freedom.
And you say the flag has a different significance to different people, a different significance to veterans in particular. What do you hear from veterans about the flag?
Well, for example, a few days before Flag Day, I had a 97-year-old veteran who also was a POW in my office just chatting. And what that flag means to that gentleman is unbelievable. It was his hope. It was his inspiration. It was the thing that kept him alive.
And just a clarification here. Can you explain why the American flag patch is worn backward on military uniforms? As we talk about veterans here, I've always wondered why that is on the uniform.
Well, again, I'm not a flag etiquette expert.
Okay.
You know, the National Flag Day Foundation is not the flag police. We are here to promote people flying the flag, to promote people honoring the flag and respecting the flag. But I believe the flag patch on the military uniforms officially changed a number of years back so that the blue field is always forward. I know there was some controversy about that, but I believe that is the current stance.
Can you give us some history of the connection to Wisconsin and the former Wisconsin school teacher and dentist, Bernard Siegrid? What happened there?
Well, I think that's a great story. You know, as most people know, June 14th, 1777, our flag was born. That's when Congress claimed the 13 stripes and blue field and stars was a U.S. flag. So then on June 14th, 1885, Dr. Bernard Seagrin had his students recognize the very first flag day or birthday of the flag, and they wrote an essay about what the flag means to them. And that became Seagrin's quest, was to get Flag Day recognized nationally.
I read that he put together this celebration that was repeated annually, and there were more than 300,000 children who took part in this celebration in parks around Chicago. Is that right?
I don't have any knowledge of that, I'm afraid.
Oh, okay. But, you know, it sounds like he really, in establishing the holiday, he really worked hard in writing about the importance of the flag and trying to, you know, ensure that people felt the same way that he did.
It became his life quest. There's no question about that. You know, his crowning glory, I think you mentioned it earlier, at age 49, President Wilson in 1916 declared, you know, Flag Day as June 14th. And then shortly after that, Seagrin passed away. And then some patriots from Pennsylvania carried on his mission. And in 1949, Congress passed the National Flag Day Bill, and Harry Truman signed it.
I'm going to reintroduce you here for a moment as we talk about the American flag, the deep history it has in Wisconsin, and maybe your home. David Janik is president of the National Flag Day Foundation, held a Flag Day celebration earlier this month, as we talked about. You can join in. Questions on the American flag, 800-642-1234. The U.S. flag code, David, outlines rules and etiquette. And I know you said you're not the etiquette expert, but Congress ratified the code 80 years ago. What are some common rules that people should follow and know about the American flag?
Well, I think the rules that I think are important are the rules that keep the American flag in the point of prominence. The U.S. flag has always flown higher than any other flag. The U.S. flag has never dipped to any other flag. There's nothing ever to the U.S. flag's own right, so that the flag carries that place of prominence. I think those things are important.
And when the flag is not flown from a staff, how should it be displayed? I mean, you said it has to be in a prominent position, but what are some ways that people can display it?
Well, I think if it's done with respect and reverence, there's no wrong way. But that's my opinion. That's Dave Janik's opinion. Like I said, I'm not the flag police. It's not what the Flag Day Foundation is about.
Can you tell me about how your foundation was started?
In 1946, a bunch of returning veterans from World War II and local business people erected a monument to Dr. Seagrin in downtown Wabaca. And that was the first Flag Day. And they have had a Flag Day celebration in Wabaca every year since 1946. And later years, in 1995, John Hemis, who had taken care of Flag Day for all those years, turned it over to my dad, Jack. And that's the year we became a 501c3. We purchased a school building from the Ozaukee County School District, created the National Flag Day headquarters that has three museums and three meeting rooms where the VFW, the Legion, the 4-H, the Scouts can all meet. And we just keep moving forward from there.
What did your dad pass down to you about the American flag?
My dad's passion and reverence for the U.S. flag was second to none. He was just relentless in getting people to fly the flag, in getting people to honor the flag, in getting people to understand what it means and how important it is and how a unifying symbol the U.S. flag is.
I would imagine you have some early childhood memories about Flag Day and about flying the flag. And I'm wondering what, when you think about those memories way back when, what were your thoughts as a child growing up around the flag?
Well, you know, those things change as you get older. As a child growing up, Flag Day was about the parade.
Sure.
You know, there was bands and marching units and clowns, and the Shriners would be there, and that's what Flag Day was. But as you get older, the morning patriotic program became more and more important, and the parade more and more secondary. Now, we still have a great parade, and it's a parade that many, many children come to because it's a big candy parade, and they love it. But the programs that we put on now, honoring different groups every year, has become something that's really special. And like this year, as I mentioned before, we honored the Honor Flight Volunteers, and the VFW and Legions really came out in force to honor those that honor them, and it was really special.
What do you want children to be taught about the American flag?
Well, I think that's another great question, because one of the things we do is we carry on Dr. Segrin's first Flag Day message of having an essay contest on what the flag means to me. And that is carried out throughout the entire country. And we get entries from school children from all over the nation. And reading the essays, I think we are creating a situation where our mission is being completed. To have their own point of views, to have their own insights into the flag, and to show the love and respect that the flag is a symbol of this country.
Hmm. David Janik with us, president of the National Flag Day Foundation based in Wabaca, which is the origin story of Flag Day, as we've been learning. Join in on the American flag's symbolism, its design, flag etiquette, how you display yours, 800-642-1234. You're listening to The Morning Show, back in a moment with David Janik here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about the American flag, its design, its history, etiquette for flying it. A poll out yesterday by YouGov measured Americans' views of the flag and other symbolic flags like the gay pride flag. And the survey found Republicans, white Americans, and older Americans are particularly likely to have a very positive view of the American flag. Join in, 800-642-1234. David Janik leads the National Flag Day Foundation and is with us for about 9 more minutes. Let's bring in Rick now in Neenah. Rick, what is your story with the flag? Oh, and Rick, I think we lost you. Hopefully Rick will call back. David, we were talking earlier about your essay contest on what the American flag means to me. How many contest entries do you get each year?
It varies, but this year I think we are about 2,500 entries from across the nation.
Wow. So you go then about reading all these entries and then selecting them. And I understand you've brought one of the essays. This is second place winner in the eighth grade division was Taylor from Hammond, Wisconsin. Can you read a few lines from Taylor's essay?
Sure, I'd love to. Is the American flag just some piece of fabric with red and white stripes and an undersized blue box and white stars? In contrast, is the flag something that represents freedom and justice in our country? Everyone has a different opinion on what the American flag truly represents for them. But most can agree with the statement that the American flag shows the true meaning of being an American. This piece of fabric, for some, is something that just hangs to show our country as a whole. But to me, it is the true American symbol of life. It shows me how to be a civilized American and how I should help make our country a better place. being a true American is using your courage to fight, your imagination to hope, and an unstoppable determination to get the job done to represent the flag. Being a true American is looking at the history of the flag shows and understanding that we have been given this freedom and we cannot take it for granted.
Mm. What do you hear in that essay? What speaks to you?
I think what speaks to me is he's pointing out that there are different opinions of what the flag means, and this is his. And I think that's important. And I do like his opinion. I have to say that, because I think that this country was built on hard work and on courage and on freedom. And we need to keep that going. That's very important.
Did you hear echoes of Taylor's words in other essays you receive? Are there some common threads or common themes?
Again, with that many essays, the answer is yes. And there is a team of people that read the essays and recategorize them until they get down to just, you know, a first and second place in each age group. But yes, there is a common theme. You know, you do feel the honoring of the veterans, the empathy for the soldiers in many of the essays. But at this, in Taylor's, it's more about the common person's look at the flag, and I think that's kind of what I hear in it.
Mm. Do you know how many flags you have personally?
I guess I do not have a count on that. I have a number of flags that are very important to me. The flag that was on my friend's casket when he was given his military funeral. Mm. And I do have a flag that was the flag when I was born. And I have the large flag that I fly in my yard. And, of course, there's all the flags at the Americanism Center. There are 27 configurations officially of the U.S. flag, and we have them all in the avenue of flags at the Americanism Center.
You're never too far from an American flag, I imagine.
No.
Let's bring in another caller now. Jay is with us from Watertown. Jay, hi, go ahead.
Yes, I actually have two questions. I'd like to ask the first question and then receive the answer and then ask the second question.
Sounds
after
good,
that.
Jay. Yes, go ahead.
Could you explain first what is exactly defacing the American flag, if you could explain that?
I'm not sure I heard the word you said.
What is considered defacing the American flag, Jay asks?
Again, I am not the flag police, and that is not what the American National Flag Day Foundation is about. What we are about is trying to teach people to treat the flag with respect. And anything that would be treating the flag without respect, I would consider defacing the American flag.
Jay, would you like to ask that second one, second parter?
Okay, well, what has always bothered me, and I've never heard anybody really voice out against it, and I support police and fire 100%, but they draw a blue line or a red line through our American flag. Isn't that considered defacing the American flag?
Thank you, Jay. David, go ahead.
I think, Jay, I think that's going to be a matter of opinion. The flag is red, white, and blue. It's red stripes and white stripes and a blue field with white stars. That's the official configuration of the U.S. flag. The other flags, like the thin blue line or the red line, those are certainly symbols of the flag, and they are certainly symbols of our country. And I think, like you said, supporting the police and supporting the fire community is very important. They're brave people. And I think I respect their symbol as well.
David Janik with us talking about the American flag, Flag Day, the national symbolism. You can join in 800-642-1234. Questions about the National Flag Day Foundation. So, David, Wisconsin, with our connections, as you've really talked about with the flag, and also having home to the largest manufacturer of flags and flagpoles in the nation. The company is Eder Flag in Oak Creek, and the National Flag Foundation is a distributor of their flag products, if you will. You know, what is demand like for American flags?
Oh, it's very high. It's very high, and for a while they were very difficult to get, but that's kind of getting back in line, and we're able to get the flags out to people that want them.
Something else I learned that I didn't know, I learned that sales and use tax is exempted in Wisconsin when you buy the American flag. I had no idea.
Yep. There's no sales tax on U.S. flags.
And another interesting thing here, Acuity Insurance in Sheboygan says it has the largest free-flying American flag in the world. You've been to the flag. Can you describe what that's like?
Oh, it is absolutely impressive. It's right on I-43 going north at Sheboygan, and you can see it for miles. When that flag is up and waving, you can just see it for miles in both directions. It is truly impressive.
When you've gotten up close to this flag, what do you feel? What is that like?
Oh, it'll send a shiver down your spine. I mean, it is awe-striking.
What do you see as the future of the National Flag Day Foundation? What are your hopes for the coming years?
We sure hope we continue to grow. We are a completely volunteer organization. You know, nobody gets a penny of wages in any way. And so we hope to carry that on because that's part of what we think makes it great. Our grounds in Wabaca, we have our own giant flag. It's flown between two electric company poles. It's about a 80 by 50 flag. And it's just a great day, and we hope to grow the patriotic program to bigger and better things. The parade has always been wonderful. And then the family day, which is our opportunity to talk to people about the flag and have a little celebration for the flag's birthday, is just a wonderful event as well, and we'd like to see that keep growing.
David, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
David Janik, president of the National Flag Day Foundation. We have a link to the foundation's website at wpr.org/mornings. Let's go out a little more of the U.S. Air Force Band performing Your Grand Old Flag. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.